Welcome back to Take Care, Dr. McStay. We always enjoy talking with you.
Great to be here. How are you guys?
We're good, but we are experiencing winter outside our windows here in the studio. So, and I, you know, when the snow falls and the ice and all that stuff is underfoot, I'm a little cautious out there. I know many people are, but I know what my fears are, but you have the reality. So, in terms of your experience as an emergency medicine doctor, what's the number one winter-related injury you see coming into the ER?
You know, it's probably slip and falls. And a lot of what we see ends up being broken wrists and broken ankles. It's so common. You know, you're just walking down the sidewalk or in your driveway and you hit a little patch of ice and people find themselves falling so quickly and unexpectedly that it's really easy to injure themselves. So when we get snow in Denver, that's kind of what we end up seeing primarily. There's a lot of other scary injuries out there. You know, we can talk about hypothermia and frostbite and other things, but day to day for most people in urban environments, it's really falling.
So in terms of the fall, of course, our instinct is to put our hands out to break the fall. If you're falling and you know, bam, it's going to happen, is there something that you can do to lessen the impact? Because I'd imagine that the wrist, the hand is a fragile thing.
Yeah, we call it a foosh injury, F-O-O-S-H, which means fall on an outstretched hand. And it's very common, you're right. And for anybody that's learned how to snowboard, you know that you spend a lot of time falling on your bottom and you fall forward, you know, hitting your elbows and your wrists. And snowboarders learn very quickly that falling on their wrists, on their hands, is a great way to break those wrists. And so, you know, it's difficult when you fall like on ice because you do end up falling so quickly. But if you can avoid kind of putting your hand out necessarily and landing on your hands, that's a good way to avoid a wrist or a, you know, a hand fracture. But it's challenging. I think most of us, when we're going down, we're putting our hands down to try to break our fall. So it's just so common, and I think probably hard for people to really avoid injury, especially when it happens so quickly.
Sometimes you can actually injure yourself by flailing around in that 3 seconds, which has happened to me on a wet garage floor. And actually, I feel like nothing really serious happened, and I did fall. But I feel like my back went out because it was something
I've actually done that.
Okay, yeah.
You can see. You're on unstable ground. Your foot slips out, and you kind of your body, you know, has intrinsic reflexes that you can't control. Your body moves on its own to maintain balance, and in the course of that slipping and readjusting, it's very easy to like jerk and twist your back, and in fact, other joints. It's very common to sprain and strain other areas of your body in that process.
So, just very quickly on the slip and fall injuries. So you slip and fall, you break your fall with your wrist. How do you know that you have to go to the ER to get x-rays? What obviously it may swell up
sure.
a little bit, but how would you know if you just have a bruise or if you have a break?
So, you know, even in the emergency department, it's sometimes hard for me to know. And that's why I have this great tool called x-ray. So to tell lay people, you know, what to worry about is a little bit tricky. I mean, what I would say is if, you know, you fall and injure yourself and you have just a small area that's maybe a little bit bruised, maybe a little bit tender, but you have good range of motion of the wrist when you move it around, it doesn't necessarily hurt you. You might not worry so much about fracture. But the people that we see who have fractures have where the hand meets the wrist, they typically have a lot of swelling, and they typically have a fair amount of tenderness over the area when they press. It doesn't actually bruise in the initial stages. It kind of swells up and is painful. So bruising isn't really something that's great to go by. But if you fall, you have a substantial mechanism of injury. Your wrist is really swollen. And it hurts when you move it back and forth. If you heard a crunch, if you feel crunching in a place that doesn't normally crunch, if you will, then you probably ought to show up and get an x-ray. There's a couple of tricky fractures in the wrist that if they're not diagnosed and they don't heal correctly, can cause people long-term pain and disability. And so for the wrist, we're particularly careful. So what I would tell people, in fact, for most kind of sprains and strains and things of that nature, if you've fallen and you've injured yourself and you're worried, go get an x-ray. An x-ray is cheap. It's simple. You don't necessarily have to go to the emergency department if you have an urgent care or a primary doctor's office that can do x-rays. That's a reasonable alternative. But a couple are, in fact, one of the types of fractures in the wrist, if it doesn't heal correctly, it can cause long-term issues and pain and stuff. So we're pretty careful with people with wrist injuries in particular.
What about shoveling-related incidents? And it's not only we hear about heart attacks from people
sure.
that are out of shape, and it can also be pulled muscles, but what about accidents also related to snow blowers? Do you see all of those things in the winter?
I can tell you in New York, I remember a couple of really devastating injuries with snowblowers, and it was one of them in particular was a gentleman that had gotten something stuck in his snowblower, and I think he was in an urban environment, and ultimately I think it was like an umbrella that was buried in snow that got stuck in the snowblower, and he did something that all of us would think is absolutely crazy, but all of us might do from time to time if we were faced with this, is that he left the snowblower running and put his hand in the device, and something happened, it slipped, and it caught his hand. So that's one way to get injured, and it's a very common sense type of thing to tell you not to do that, but we see it from time to time. The other thing to be careful about with snowblowers is that it does eject debris out the side. So just be careful if passerbys are coming through, just to warn them or to turn off the machine when people are around. And the other injuries that you might see with a snowblower are kind of just related to walking on unstable surfaces. So make sure that if you're doing snow blowing, you're wearing boots, you're wearing something that has good traction and supports your ankles. And then just generally related to outdoor activities, you should dress warm. And you should certainly be wearing gloves. We know, and you've probably all felt this, when you have cold hands, bare hands in a cold day, and if you're touching metal objects, that metal tends to really suck out the heat from the hand. And it's actually pretty easy to get cold-related injuries if you're barehanding a snowblower or another metal object. So just be careful.
What about the idea that, you're shoveling snow, you're not used to that level of physical activity, and all of a sudden you have a massive heart attack and die? Is that an urban legend, or does that really happen?
Just about 2 weeks ago, when we had a big snowstorm here, I saw that exact thing in an individual. And, shoveling snow is really hard. If you've done it, you know how heavy the snow can be. If there's a large amount of snow, it can take you a long period of time to actually clear it, and it's a hard job. So we kind of joke in medicine about being a stress test on the heart, if you will. If you're being evaluated for coronary artery disease, one of the things that we do is actually it's a stress test. So we attach them to EKG leads, we put them on a treadmill, and we exercise them. And when we exercise them, if they in fact have coronary artery disease, we can see changes on the EKG that indicate that there's disease there. So that's a stress test. So we kind of joke, from an urban legend kind of standpoint, that shoveling snow is like a stress test. You're out there, you're working hard. And it's not uncommon to see people on those days who it's typically early in the morning, people are out and they exercise and sort of stress the heart, if you will, and develop chest pain and kind of expose their underlying coronary artery disease. I've seen it probably at least 10 times in my career.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Reff.
And we are discussing winter-specific injuries with Dr. Christopher McStay, Chief of Clinical Operations in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Dr. McStay, one of the things that we don't blink about in the summer is if we get wet, but in winter, whether it's something related to falling through the ice or somehow getting wet, getting a good soaking, and the temperatures are at or below freezing, that's always been one of those things that I think to myself, okay, what is the first thing that I would do in that situation, and how long do I have before I have to start worrying about frostbite or hypothermia?
Sure. It's a great question. Let's put it into perspective. Somewhere around 2,000 people a year in the United States die of weather-related injuries. And the last number that I looked at a couple of days ago was 63% of people who die from weather-related injuries die of cold-related injuries. So something like 1,300 people a year or so. So it's a real killer. You think about lightning and how scary that is. Probably something like 40 to 50 people in the United States die of lightning-related injuries. So cold is, it's a real killer, and it's a real concern, especially in the winter and especially in environments that are conducive to it, where people expose themselves. We see a fair amount of people who succumb to cold injuries from a variety of ways. In urban environments, it's more commonly people that are chronically intoxicated, typically folks that are homeless, who, unlike me, don't have a cell phone that gives you weather alerts, right, that it's going to be cold tonight. So they're often unfamiliar with weather patterns and things. So typically what we see in our urban emergency departments is individuals that get intoxicated, fall asleep outside in an unexpected way and then come in very, very cold. So that's one, sort of scary mechanism. The other thing that we see, and it often does relate to being wet, is individuals that are out in the wilderness or exposed or fall through ice. And, you know, I think there's a common misperception out there that if you fall through the ice that you're going to die, you know, in a matter of minutes, or you're going to become profoundly hypothermic or cold in a matter of minutes. And the reality is the body's pretty good at keeping one warm, and it takes much longer than lay people think to become hypothermic. So if you fall through the ice, you may have difficulty, you know, moving and become weak, if you will, because of the cold on the muscles. But one doesn't truly become profoundly hypothermic for many minutes, maybe even up to an hour or so, kind of depending on conditions. So that's just something to think about. The main thing that one can do when one gets wet or one is exposed is, you know, to avoid getting wet at all. If you're, you know, in a wilderness environment, stay out of the cold, because cold kills, and especially cold clothing that is cotton kills. We often joke in wilderness circles that, you know, cotton kills. When cotton gets wet, it absolutely reduces its ability to insulate the body. So in circumstances where you yourself get cold and wet, or you find someone who's cold and wet, getting them out of that wet environment and drying them off and getting them out of wet clothing is actually incredibly important.
What about carbon monoxide poisoning? When I was researching this piece, I was surprised to find that on the list. I now have read about it, and I understand there are occasional accidents. And one of them that I had known about years ago just happened, and I can't remember if it was on the national news, but people were trying to stay warm in their car. They backed their car up into a snowbank, and it blocked off the exhaust. And they wound up dying of carbon monoxide poisoning. I'm guessing that's relatively rare. What do you hear about or see in the emergency room related to that?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. My my medical toxicology colleagues would be remiss if we hadn't discussed it. There's a lot of ways in which people get themselves into trouble with carbon monoxide. You know, I think classically we think about it as a way that people unfortunately think about committing suicide. You know, one puts their car in a garage, closes the door, turns it on, and you know, succumbs to the carbon monoxide. It's actually a very lethal substance, carbon monoxide. In the winter, we see a couple different mechanisms. One is, you know, what you mentioned in terms of, you know, the exhaust of a car in a snowbank. Probably more commonly, we see it with people who use generators to heat their homes. And so individuals may accidentally store the generator in an interior part of a house, use that generator to power a space heater or something like that, and then end up getting themselves in trouble with carbon monoxide. In urban environments, you know, occasionally we'll see it with burners or boilers or heating devices that are inappropriately vented. But it's a real killer. I mean, individuals that succumb from carbon monoxide, I mean, it certainly can kill people. People that survive will often end up with profound neurologic and neuropsychiatric sequelae, or, you know, things that can mimic stroke and can really be quite, quite devastating. So it's something to think about if you have a neighbor or you're hearing about people that are using generators to keep themselves warm. It's something to discuss with people and to keep your eye on.
What kind of symptoms are you going to experience when you start becoming poisoned by carbon monoxide?
Sure. The first thing that people notice is they generally get a little bit of a headache. And so, and just to back up to say that, you know, we all have smoke detectors in our home. Having a carbon monoxide detector in our home is probably as important, if not more important, because the signs can be a little bit subtle. You know, a smoke detector goes off when there's smoke and fire, which is typically obvious to us. But carbon monoxide is much more subtle in the way that it presents itself. It's, you know, usually not associated you know, with a fire, unless there is a fire in the home, but, you know, associated with a generator or devices that are malfunctioning. So make sure you get one. The symptoms are, you know, as I mentioned, kind of headache, feeling generally unwell, malaise, that type of thing. And as the carbon monoxide levels build in the human body, one becomes more and more lethargic and sleepy, and ultimately can become comatose. When individuals come to the emergency department, they can, you know, manifest with all kinds of different things, but usually they're sleepy, altered. Sometimes they can have seizures and usually appear quite ill. The treatment for that, you know, is to basically put them in a hyperbaric chamber, the same type of chamber that we use to treat people who have what people refer to as the bends or diving injuries, because that concentrated oxygen at high pressure helps to sort of drive out the carbon monoxide and is a definitive treatment for the disease.
So we have just about a minute left to talk about other winter-related injuries that happen. We're purposely not bringing up winter sports because I'm sure you see your fair share in Colorado of sledding injuries, skiing, snowboarding, ice skating, and we know wear a helmet, be smart, don't do these activities when you're fatigued. But are there other things that we're not mentioning that you see in the ER that are related to winter injuries?
And I have to ask about the falling icicle. I mean, you know, that the A Christmas Story made that famous where Ralphie blames his his injury when it's the BB gun.
I've never seen anybody personally impaled by an icicle, but, you know, with people who have homes who have been dealing with ice dams and big icicles hanging off the side of their house, it certainly could happen. You know, I've seen people shoveling snow off their roofs who have fallen off. So, I get it. You want to clear snow off your roof, but you've got to be incredibly careful. And then, we'll see kids occasionally who are out sledding, not on sleds, but using trash can lids or slick mats and going headfirst down snowbanks. And, you know, it's either the kids themselves that they get injured or the kids that are standing by who get run into. So just be thoughtful and careful when you're out sledding with kids. It's a really fun activity. I think a lot of the national organizations recommend that kids wear helmets. Just be careful and be thoughtful about how you're sledding with your kids.
Dr. Christopher McStay, Chief of Clinical Operations in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Thanks so much for your time.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much.